Ever wondered about the correct pronunciation of this one's name?
Sylvia Poggioli.
All right, let me try it. Sylvia Poggioli.
Very good.
Okay, now you try it. Looks like it's back to the Radio Academy with you, or a timeout in the 25 years ago NPR Wayback Machine. I'm Carrie Thompson. This month, it's April 1987, and as it turns out, a particularly creative year for NPR producers coming up with hallucinogenic April Fool's stories.
Up and down the valleys, the trucks roll out, carrying fresh duct tape out of the Olympic Forest. More duct tape is grown in Washington than anywhere else in the world.
Yes, you heard right. A story on the duct tape harvest in Washington State. But wait, there's more. We'll have a great interview with one of my very favorite actors, Gregory Peck.
I've always felt that when I was right on and won the accolades, it was probably because I followed a very close emotional identification with the role.
And yes, speaking of emotional, we'll have a first-hand account of that large, ill-fated ship that's been sinking over and over recently with Titanic survivor Ava Hart.
He put my mother and I into a lifeboat and stood back himself and made no attempt to get in.
Huh. Did he survive?
No.
And as Celine Dion says, this story will live on and on until the next quarter century rolls around and we'll probably air it again. Let's start off with the story I promised in a previous episode of this podcast. Ira Glass produced this story, and it has since become an NPR classic. Here's Noah Adams.
When I was a boy, listening to the radio, I couldn't figure out the words to the song Mare's-eat-oats. You know, mare's-eat-oats and does-eat-oats and little lambs eat ivy. A kid will eat ivy too, wouldn't you?
Mare's-eat-oats and does-eat-oats and little lambs eat ivy. A kid will eat ivy too, wouldn't you? Mare's-eat-oats and does-eat-oats and little lambs eat ivy. A kid will eat ivy too, wouldn't you?
That song Mare's-eat-oats was a novelty tune. But then once rock and roll took over, indecipherable lyrics became quite commonplace. In fact, most people who listen to the radio have at one time in their lives misinterpreted the words to a song.
The song, all we are saying is give peace a chance. Okay, a friend thought it was, all we are saying is give me some cash.
My friend Susan was convinced for the longest time that Mick Jagger did a song. She was thinking of the song Beast of Burden. She thought the lyrics were, never leave your pizza burning.
I'll never be your beast of burden.
Well, it's I'm so hot for you, but Dad always thought it was I'm so affable. Because it makes sense. I'm so affable, but you're so cold.
I'm so affable.
My family used to Christmas carol every year, and so we'd go through our list of standard carols. And one year, this tiny cousin of mine said, okay, let's do the one about Park Down Here. And everyone said, Park Down Here? What are you talking about? And she started to sing, and it turned out it was the carol that starts out, Hearken all, hear the angels sing. And she thought they were singing, Park Down Here, the angels sing.
The Star Spangled Banner, whenever they said through the perilous night, I always thought they were saying through the parallel bars, until once I was at a baseball game and they had the words flashing on the screen, and then I saw through the perilous night and thought that they had made a mistake until everybody around me told me that I was wrong.
Well, I had a friend who was an actual bebop arranger and knew a million songs, and he thought that the great Johnny Mercer song, Fools Rush In, you know, Fools Rush In, where wise men never go. He thought it was Fools Rush In, where white men never go, for white men never fall in love.
I grew up in the south of England, and the Beatles song, She's Got a Ticket to Ride, I always used to think it's She's Got a Ticket to Rye, R-Y-E, which was this town on the Isle of Wight.
She's got a ticket to Rye. She's got a ticket to Rye. She's got a ticket to Rye, but she don't care.
Well, there was this Michael Jackson song called Human Nature. The way that I thought it was sung was, right to life, tell him that it's human nature. The words are why, and not right to life. Sounds better my way.
If they say why, tell them that it's human nature. Why, does he do it that way?
The song is Delta Dawn,
But for the longest time, I thought that they were saying, El Kabong, what's that flower you had on? Doesn't that come from some old TV program where they smash someone over the head with a guitar or something? I think it does. They go, El Kabong, and they crash someone over the head with this guitar.
And the other one is from Bad Moon on the Rise, which, of course, like everyone else in the country, I thought was, there's a bathroom on the right.
There's a bad moon on the right.
A friend of ours at work, he said that in the Police song, Every Breath You Take, the words, how my poor heart aches, he always thought that they were saying, I'm a pool hall ace.
Okay, the song was Blinded by the Light, and it sounds like, should I sing here? Okay, blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche and a runner in the night. That's what it sounds like. You know, and everybody thinks that.
Wrapped up like a douche and a runner in the night.
Greetings from Asbury Park. It actually has the lyrics printed on the back, and the answer is, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. And I'm from New Jersey, so, you know.
The other one that I always got wrong was the Four Tops' Bernadette, which for about 15 years lived in my mind as Burn to Death. They sing Bernadette, and I always thought it was Burn to Death. Just a cruel, hard lyric of torture. The thing about me is that it sticks, the wrong one sticks, so my miscomprehension stays. I'll always sing it Burnt to Death.
A kiddly-divey too, wouldn't you?
Wouldn't you?
Yeah, I might. I'll tell you what, though. I would not have considered running for president in 1987 if I was this guy.
Another candidate has entered the race for the White House. Today, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis officially announced his bid for the 1988 Democratic nomination. Andrew Caffrey of member station WBUR in Boston has more.
Dukakis decided to run for president after a resounding re-election victory last November. He was also encouraged by the national attention he received for the so-called Massachusetts economic miracle. Now in his third term, he has presided over a state economy that has gone from bust to boom. Massachusetts now has a thriving high-tech industry and one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. In laying out his campaign themes, Dukakis singles out economic opportunity as his number one objective.
I believe our children have a right to live in a land with vibrant and sustained economic growth and with genuine economic opportunity for every single American in every part of this country.
A poll out today by a Boston newspaper shows Dukakis far behind the other candidates in Iowa.
George H.W. Bush was considered the front runner in the 1988 presidential race. Here's pollster Lou Harris with some early public perceptions of Bush's candidacy.
Going for Vice President Bush are two assets. First, 7 in 10 think he certainly has the proper experience to be president. Second, 6 in 10 think that he should be given the chance to complete the Reagan program. That's his advantage as the heir to the Reagan political legacy. And yet, by 57% to 39%, a clear majority of Republicans reject the claim that as the number two man to Reagan, Bush would be the strongest candidate the GOP can nominate. He has still other troubles. The Iran-Contra affair could haunt him. 42% think he's been too much associated with that episode to be trusted as president, and a 52% to 39% majority feels he's not telling the truth when he claims, after the arms deal went sour, that he never supported it in the first place. That could be a no-win situation for George Bush. The heart of his problem, though, seems to be just a plain case of what past history has called the emasculation of the vice president. a 53-44% majority agrees with the charge that in trying to prove to everyone that he's in total agreement with President Reagan, he's lost much of his own personality and is just a wimp. A big 50%.
The emasculation of the vice president. Now a miniseries on HBO starring Julia Louise Dreyfus.
Her name is...
And in April 1987, one of public radio's rising stars was becoming known as that reporter in Italy with the exotic-sounding name.
Sylvia Poggioli.
All right, let me try it, because I have to say it every now and then. Sylvia Poggioli.
Very good.
Oh, thank you. As you've certainly guessed by now, speaking with us is the journalist who has been NPR's contract reporter in Italy for the past 5 years. This network receives a great deal of mail asking us, who is Sylvia Poggioli? Or sometimes, how is it that you pronounce Sylvia Poggioli's name? So she's been visiting Washington for the past few days and is with us in the studios now. Hello.
Hi.
How did you get to Italy? How did you become a reporter there?
Well, I ended up there as I had a Fulbright scholarship after I graduated from college.
Uh-huh.
And I just stayed.
Yeah. Now, this was in
1968.
When the Italian universities were closed.
Exactly.
So I didn't study
very much.
So you got to know the country a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware at all of the mail that we get, or the what amounts to these Sylvia Poggioli, forgive me, cells that form throughout the country?
No, I really didn't
know. Want pictures of Sylvia, and how do we pronounce Sylvia's name?
No, I didn't know about it.
Really?
No,
I guess we don't forward that stuff to you in Rome.
No.
Do you feel in touch with this country? I say that as someone who's been based overseas, too.
Yeah.
And I know I came back and just didn't know a lot. Well, television shows were popular that I didn't remember, flavors of ice cream I'd never heard of, all that kind of stuff. What's it like for you, having been over there all this time?
Well, I think each time I come back, the gap is narrower, because uh-huh. there's so much more communication. All the kids look like American kids. There's fast food places all over Italy now. TV shows, Dynasty Dallas is on, Hill Street Blues even, mm-hmm. Miami Vice. So there's a much more narrower gap. Europeans generally, and Italians, I think, also very much in particular, are having a big love affair with American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know much more than they used to.
You know, it's not the most important question I've ever asked in my life, but I've been dying to ask it of you. I bet when you left this country in the late 60s, we were eating something called spaghetti. And you come back here now in the 80s, and we're eating pasta.
That's right.
Well, is it the real stuff, or have we been had?
Oh, now, it's getting very good now.
Here in the United States?
Oh, it's getting to be very good.
I'm glad we had a chance to have this chat.
I'm very happy to.
Okay, thank you very much. Sylvia Poggioli, who's NPR's contract reporter based in Rome. Sylvia, help me, please.
Poggioli.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Ms. Hart, why were you on the Titanic? Were you going on vacation?
No, I was with my parents. My father was going to open a business in Canada.
Ava Hart was 7 years old when she started the journey from Southampton to New York on the ship that God himself couldn't sink. Hart talked to Susan Stamberg.
When the ship hit that iceberg, did you, as a young child, understand that the situation was as bad as it turned out to be?
Firstly, I was sound asleep, and I was wakened and taken up onto the deck, and I didn't know why everybody was rushing about. It didn't dawn on me until the time came to get into a lifeboat. I don't think, really, the actual seriousness of it touched me even then. It was when I left my father that it touched me.
Mm-hmm.
He put my mother and I into a lifeboat and stood back himself and made no attempt to get in.
Huh. Did he survive?
No.
No. There were more than 1,500 who went down
Yes.
with the Titanic. How many of you, those of you who survived, are still alive? Do you have any idea, Miss Hart?
Well, there are 9 here at the moment. I know of 3 more in England, but very few.
What's the feeling amongst you survivors in particular about the recent discovery of the remains of the Titanic and the notion...
I can't answer for anyone else. But very firmly, I can tell you that I think it was a wonderful scientific achievement. It doesn't touch me as being part of the Titanic, inasmuch as it doesn't upset me in any way. And I do think it's quite wonderful. And I have a great admiration for Dr. Ballard as a scientist, and a great admiration that he agrees with me that we should not attempt to bring anything up from the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. That is your feeling?
Absolutely, firmly. And I was very pleased when he said the same thing.
Good. Thank you so much, Eva Hart, a survivor of the Titanic disaster. Best of luck to you, Miss Hart.
Thank you very much. And you.
And thank you, Miss Hart. She passed away in 1996. Now for a profile of actor Gregory Peck.
In person, he's a tall man with a big voice. On screen, he can dominate a movie. He was Ahab in Moby Dick in 1956.
Whosoever of ye finds me, that white whale, ye shall have this Spanish gold ounce, my boys.
Without any question, the symbolism of the white whale is a malevolent god. If God is not malevolent, why is there suffering, agony, misery, starvation, and torture in this world? Did he put us here just to play games with us? This was Melville's shaking his fist, so to speak, at the heavens through the character of Captain Ahab. I always thought he was a crazy old guy, and I enjoyed doing it, but I can't say that I identified with it very closely.
Peck often played representative characters. At the end of the 1950 Western, The Gunfighter, he was shot down, and his death was like the end of the West itself. In the same year as General Frank Savage in 12 O'Clock High, he helped win World War II. This is Peck in his Oscar-winning role in the 1962 movie To Kill a Mockingbird.
How old were you when you got your first gun, Atticus?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much, and that I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Some actors give very good accounts of themselves with pure technique, without too much emotional involvement. I would say that without the slightest desire to denigrate Cary Grant, that his art was almost pure technique. And I loved to watch him on the screen, and so did a few hundred million other people. You could say that the opposite would be Marlon Brando or Bob De Niro, who act out of an emotional subterranean level that goes like a river. And their utterances, their reading of lines, is entirely a reaction to the movement of that underground river. The emotion is the music, and the script is the libretto. So that is really the basis of what's known as the method, or acting out of emotional truth. Those kind of actors let the exterior take care of itself, feeling that it will be right, look right, and sound right if they've got a grasp on the emotional truth below the lines. I had that training, and I've always felt that when I was right on and won the accolades, it was probably because I followed those principles, either consciously or subconsciously. A very close emotional identification with the role.
In a new movie called Amazing Grace and Chuck, Gregory Peck plays the President of the United States. In this sequence, he talks about being a public person.
One thing I never really figured on, I started out was that
When my career was over and I'd done just about everything I wanted to do, I could never really go back. Just go back to the people I loved without the whole world watching. I never knew I was buying into that.
Well, I decided I wouldn't be intimidated by the role, and that I wouldn't try to do a lot of fancy acting, characterization with a Southern accent or a Boston accent, or in any way imitate any of the recent presidents. I decided that it could be me, and so I stayed very close to myself. It's what you see up there is pretty much me.
Duke Ellington was born on April 29th, 1899. Producer Becca Pulliam talked to several musicians who worked with Ellington. She has this report.
The tenor saxophonist Harold Ashby was with the Ellington Orchestra for more than 10 years. It began with a telephone call in 1960.
He said, "This is Duke Ellington. Said, I would like for you to work with me tonight and tomorrow night." And I thought there was some fella playing a prank, you know. So I said, "Well, yeah, okay, man," and hung the phone up.
Ashby and Ellington both lived on St. Nicholas Avenue in Harlem, a block apart between 156th and 157th Street. That morning, the Ellington bus was parked on the avenue.
So Duke called right back, and he said, "Look, the bus is on 155th and St. Nicholas. Go down and catch the bus." And then I realized it was Duke, and I said, "Okay." It was about 5 or 10 minutes had passed, and the phone rang again, and Duke said, "Look, you haven't left yet?" He said, "Go on down and catch the bus."
Duke Ellington appreciated people, from the King of Thailand to the Queen of England to each of the 15 or 16 men who played in his band at any given time over 5 decades. In New York, the Reverend John Garcia Gensel has ministered to the jazz community for nearly 25 years.
He had rabbis, he had priests, he had pastors who were all his friends. They all clamored after him. I always hesitated almost to go and see him in his dressing room after a concert because I didn't want to bug him because everybody was around him. But whenever he saw me, oh, he said, "John, you know," and he was absolutely wonderful.
George Ween is the impresario who founded the Newport Jazz Festival 30 years ago.
He had this wonderful way with women. A woman could be not necessarily pretty, but perhaps she had nice eyes. Duke knew exactly what to say to that woman to make her feel that he noticed her. He would say, "You have the most beautiful eyes I've ever seen." He would say, "You make that dress look very beautiful." And that made a woman, women feel great. He just made them feel good, and he made all people feel good.
Like many in the jazz business, Ween is a musician, a pianist. Between the festivals he produces, he takes his small group on tour, including Harold Ashby playing tenor, and many times they play Duke Ellington.
My total approach to the presentation of the music, I learned from Duke Ellington. Just the pacing between numbers, the introductions, not the playing, because I couldn't even begin to play like Duke Ellington, but the concept of reaching an audience.
This is Ellington introducing his 8-part suite, the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, for the 1971 recording.
The title was inspired by a statement made by Mr. Marshall McLuhan of the University of Toronto. Mr. McLuhan says that the whole world is going Oriental and that no one will be able to retain his or her identity, not even the Orientals. And, of course, we travel around the world a lot, and in the last 5 or 6 years, we too have noticed this thing to be true.
Pastor Gensel says that Ellington was sometimes criticized for lacking political awareness or involvement. But Gensel recalls that Ellington was highly conscious of racial issues all his life.
Long before anybody started to use the word black in reference to Negroes, he was way ahead. For instance, in 1927, he wrote Black and Tan Fantasy. In 1934, Symphony in Black. In 1936, Black Butterfly. In 1938, Black Beauty. In 1943, his famous Black, Brown, and Beige. His sounds, jungle music, the way that he composed, the way that he wrote, was way, way ahead of his time.
As a mentor to jazz musicians, Ellington had few equals, and when he encouraged a younger talent, it became unforgettable. Pianist Billy Taylor remembers an incident from the nightclub Birdland in 1953.
The band was really doing very well in those days. They had a record out, and people were requesting the performance of Skin Deep with Louis Belson playing a really fantastic, wall-shattering drum solo. And that was their closing number, and the audience would be screaming, and everybody would be excited and everything. And I had to follow all of this as a piano solo. And I'm saying, oh, boy, I'm really in trouble this time. Duke, the master showman that he was, would not allow that to happen on his show. As he finished, he thanked everyone graciously, and he said, I want you to know that Louis Belson loves you, and everyone in the band loves you, and said, we love you madly. And then he talked some more. And as he talked, the whole sound level of the room went down, down, down. When it finally got down to an acceptable level, he said, I had a music teacher once, and she told me that whatever I did, I should never follow the next gentleman on the piano. So I want to present Mr. Billy Taylor.
Born in Washington, D.C., April 29, 1899, the orchestra leader, composer, and pianist Duke Ellington would be 88 this year. For National Public Radio in New York, I'm Becca Pulliam.
On April 1st, like clockwork, public radio producers everywhere drop the routine news stories they're putting together and take up with a more exotic variety. The April Fool's piece. Here's one about the duct tape harvest in Washington State.
It's here, high in the Olympic Mountains, that the duck bushes thrive in the summer rain and heavy winter snow. In the spring, the hillsides burst into brilliant pink blossoms as far as the eye can see. It's during these months that the duck bushes must be thinned, and it's hot, tedious work, still done by hand as it has been for hundreds of years. Native Squish Squash Indians first discovered that the sticky silver bark was useful for mending canoes and repairing broken arrows. As settlers from the east moved into the area in the late 1800s, boom towns sprang up everywhere, dependent on the duct tape industry.
Yeah, we're working for the 3M boys now. We must have put in over 50,000 acres of duck bushes so far this year.
Up and down the valleys, the trucks roll out, carrying fresh duct tape out of the Olympic Forest. More duct tape is grown in Washington than anywhere else in the world. It's the perfect combination of bright sun, warm rain, and rich volcanic soil that makes Washington duct tape shinier and stickier than any other kind. The next stop on its journey is here, in this warehouse, where it's inspected by the U.S. Department of Adhesives.
What we're looking for here are two things, color and adhesion. When people go to the store to buy tape, they want silver tape, not gray or light blue or something like that. As far as we're concerned, if it's not silver, it's not duct tape.
Each roll is checked by skilled sorters, and those that don't make the grade are processed into flypaper and hair removers. It takes a trained eye to pick out the tiny flaws and nuances that mean the difference between sticky and extra sticky Washington duct tape. Then it's back on the trucks and onto a store shelf in your town, the end of the line for over 5 billion rolls of duct tape each year. Washington produces over half the duct tape used in America, and new markets are expanding all over the world in fields like agriculture.
Got all these cattle duct tapes together. Over 3,000 head. We don't even need fences anymore.
And medicine.
Well, how are we doing today?
Not bad, Doc. I think I'm feeling a little better.
Good. Let's have a look at that incision.
So whether you live on the other side of the world or right here in America, you're sure to find sticky Washington duct tape at the low-budget variety store just down the street.
They call me Dr. Sticky because I stick to things.
Thanks for listening. Next month, we'll contemplate what would have been if Democratic presidential candidate Gary Hart had not been photographed in a famous bit of monkey business. And Robin Leach, the man who brings us lifestyles for the rich and famous, talks to Susan Stamberg. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
I think I'm gonna be full of soul.